And before opening up to questions, I want to ask a really dumb question, but I hope you'll forgive me, which is your relationship to the systems with which you work. It's not an ambivalence, I feel. There's a critique, and yet there's also simultaneously an investment and an attraction. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you could open that a little bit for me, because I come in and out of it like that as well, repelled and attracted.
So. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely not a dumb question. I think that's a pretty, like, that's one of the things that I'm always thinking about with what I do, is this kind of tension between critique and complicity, particularly when you're working within very widely used media. And, you know, this thing of how to approach it, is it something that you should say, that stuff's bad and my critique is going to be one of turning away and having nothing to do with it, which is potentially one way of doing it, or is there a way that you can kind of do it from within? And I think that's been talked about a lot in terms of, like, Keller Easterling has spoken about kind of compliant activism, that it's a certain form of kind of submission or over-identification with some of these systems as a way to make visible and expose some of their workings and some of their logic, and to denaturalize them so that it's not just like, oh, well, that's just how this stuff goes, or that's just how it is. By using humor and kind of over investing in it to bring it to light. But at the same time, I think there's also a danger with kind of over identification, which is that at some point it can very easily shade into just reinforcing things, which is like reinforcing the existence of Facebook, or reinforcing these things which you're also attempting to critique or to bring to light. So it's not, I don't necessarily have an answer to where I sit within them, but that's something that I'm constantly looking out for and wondering, well, where actually am I on that line, you know?
Thank you. I'm aware of time, so Emma, can I have a microphone? Or it won't pick up. Thank you.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about, you said quite early on about the conjunction and then also disjunction between what's staged, or staging and the real, and you used it at the beginning of your bedroom. And I was thinking maybe it becomes more stagey when we see it, that kind of incremental. And then with the later, or the work you showed later, showed us later on in the talk,
the phone screen, does that
become a kind of place of where the staging your means? Because it's like surprising. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm saying there's something interesting
definitely
about that conjunction or disjunction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's something that I've been really interested in throughout, like this, particularly when you're performing things or when you're working in a kind of performative mode, that question of what is staged and what is unstaged, and the sense that there's a kind of attachment to a reality effect or to a kind of immediacy, to that sense that, like, this is real, which seems to have value, I think, particularly in the arts, in the way that maybe it doesn't in the theatre. So the way that I've thought about this is, like, I feel like artists who work with performance or who do performances, at some point there's a kind of rejection of skill. And I even said it myself, where it's like, oh, I don't want it to become perfect. Whereas in the theatre, you wouldn't get on stage unless you were doing it just right. So there is, I think, in the art world, there's an attachment to this sense of a kind of reality effect. And things being unstaged or unscripted or potentially to go wrong is part of what provides that. I think you're right to kind of draw this connection maybe between, like, the bedroom and the webcam and then the phone as being these spaces where it's almost as if giving you a view into kind of my real world or my intimate quarters, and how that kind of changes, has changed even just in a few years.
Can I be allowed to comment on that answer? Is that okay?
I don't know.
Yeah, of course.
Are you happy with that?
I don't mind.
It's like a second question.
Yeah.
Okay, you can have a second question.
I saw a really fantastic, Lana Hamaday did a performance of her alien character stuff on Saturday, which was extraordinary. But afterwards she was saying, because you mentioned like the difference between theatre and not, she said, this isn't a sound book, this is a sound play. I'm aligning myself with drama, not with art. And when galleries call my, they call the props, I guess, for the performance, so they call them installations, and she said, but they're just fucking stage sets. And it was the first time I've heard. It's just your answer made me think more about what she said about choosing to align yourself and how that might change the work somehow. But thank you.
Yeah. Definitely something I think about a lot every time I'm doing a performance is that, because the thing is that if it's all completely improvised and could all go wrong, then that's also not, potentially that's going to be a really crap performance. But if it's all completely scripted and I'm just doing something that I learnt off by heart, which couldn't go wrong, then I'm not really interested in doing it. There's a point at which I'm kind of repelled, and I don't know if that is my kind of art history, training, which is to somehow kind of not become too skilled, not become too polished at that. I don't know.
But remember that actors, as part of an acting training, you're trained in the skills of improvisation.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that you improvise perfectly because you know how to do it.
Yeah.
There can't be a failure in your improvisation.
And which, funnily, as artists, it's not really something that you're taught, but you are kind of expected to be able to do it to an extent because of having to do talks and Q&As. That's a kind of improvisation as well.
I just wondered, I don't know much about how these algorithms work or how they pick up information about us online, but to me I've got a sense of your work, and I don't know if this is even a question, but it was like you were acting out the algorithmic kind of interpretation of yourself, which is a really kind of, I don't know, terrifying and flippant thing to do, is to make this masses of information that people gather on us and turn into, I just wonder how can you, I don't know, it just seems like a really flippant way of treating this
quite dark subject. I mean, it's funny actually, the person who said that to me before is my mum.
Your super ego.
Yeah. But I think, it's like, it is dark subject matter, but I think if you approach, if you look at a certain type of kind of black humour, that's, which also is kind of part of the way that I work. There's something, if it's just like dark stuff and it's just presented very dark, I don't know. To me, that kind of it shuts it down too much, and it doesn't allow for any space of what, where humour or something else can allow a bit of a kind of gap or a bit of a distance, and also to see that even as all of this stuff may be true, we're not actually living as robots, kind of under the dominion of these algorithms. There is still a space of kind of unreadability, and why not be flippant with it, or kind of why not bring up some of the contradictions and some of the kind of ridiculousness of it.
Hilarity.
Yeah, of where it goes wrong, because there's also that. There's a lot of kind of where it goes wrong and what can be done with that within it as well.
We pass the microphone back to Andrew. There is a PhD student at the Royal College of Design who is making herself, is becoming an algorithm.
Wow, who's that?
I can't remember her name.
Okay, well,
she, but you might be interested.
Yeah, definitely.
Andrea.
I'm just quite interested in this kind of playing with the public and the private, and the bringing the private out of the public, and then again with the fact that there's all of these systems all the time that are taking what we think is private and using it in the public, and how you kind of regulate what you design from your diaries or visions of your private to make it public. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, that's a good question, and that line is always seems to be shifting. And one of the things that I've kind of thought as well is what from all of this stuff really is private, or even like what do we determine as the private sphere? Is it what's behind the password wall? Is it what others can't see, or what we only choose to share with them? And, you know, arguably, if all of the information, it's not actually ours, we just have access to it. So maybe it's not actually private to begin with anyway, in some kind of global sense. But there is this question of, you know, making something intimate or personal, you know, what happens when you share it. I had partly been influenced, especially in the past, by what does it mean to overshare? And the idea of, you know, even when I said before, like TMI, like what is that? Too much information. That is a kind of cultural consensus, a kind of understanding that we have of like, that's too much. And at the same time, it can be linked into ideas of attention grabbing and kind of taking more space for yourself, because if you say really outrageous stuff, you probably will be more visible. And that, you know, is that maybe a tactic as well, of becoming more visible? And what would that visibility mean? I mean, I think maybe the answer to that is, you know, it could also lead to feeling very overexposed, which I've also had. It might not be completely apparent from my work, but from the way that I described it there, but after the publication of the outage, I did feel very, very overexposed, and in a way that was quite hard to describe, because I hadn't ever felt that before, that self-consciousness. And after that, I did start to kind of withdraw, and that's why some of my work then became more about withdrawing. The other thing is that I think because of some of the processes I use and some of the software, some of them act themselves as a kind of privacy filter. So like with negative dots, you know, as it gets faster and faster, i.e. more and more negative, it also gets a lot harder to follow, and my voice can't keep up, and that in itself masks the text in some way. So unless you, the viewer, is put in the position of really having to scan it and are almost made to have to play the game as well, then the speed and also the voice not being able to keep up acts as a kind of barrier, if you see what I mean, because you're only getting part of it.
In my when I watched it on my little screen in my tiny room in the residency I was doing, I really wished I hadn't watched it, because I was paying exactly that attention to detail in it, and it was overwhelming.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I mean, actually,
and here,
yeah, and part of why I didn't want to put it online is also because you don't necessarily know who's coming to it and what mental state they're in, but because of course each frame can be frozen, and you could kind of read into it, and you could, you know, if you were obsessive, you could go through it, you know, frame by frame, and essentially read the text. So there's a way in which once you would allow that video into the control of somebody else's cursor, then that kind of element of privacy is gone. So now that it's online, yeah, that's kind of a moot point.
I wanted to ask about our sense of identity, which some people say is very fragile, or maybe fragile. And it seemed that you were exposing, inviting, exploring this representation of your identity.
Definitely.
It's very brave, but is that difficult sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, the project that I skipped over actually was one where I invited other writers to search my archive and imagine the missing media that was within it.
And it had to be someone who didn't know
me. And it had to be somebody who didn't know me. Actually, you did one of the voiceovers for it. For the video, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot that, because I know Joanna Walsh.
Yeah, Joanna Walsh.
Because you didn't know her.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's it, you put me in touch with her.
Yeah.
Yes, it all becomes clear now.
And I know we were talking about Emma writing something and you felt it was too close.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
To what you already. So there were kind of internalised rules that are logic. Sorry, back to Sarah's question.
I mean, that in itself was really difficult working out. Who is a stranger? Who do you not know? Because that you really have to go quite far now, especially if you do share a lot of yourself online. You know, you have to go quite far to really find somebody who is a complete stranger, who isn't connected to you, or who you don't somehow already kind of interact with on Twitter. But yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point there, which is this thing of kind of almost inviting misrepresentation. I don't know. Sometimes it's to do almost looking at like a comparison between a human interpreting you and also some kind of system interpreting you, and what's the difference, and how do they compare, and you know, what is the risk that you take when you allow another human to see you, and kind of what potentially can go wrong is definitely built into it. But that's, I mean, these gestures of risk are something which I'm really interested in the work in terms of, I guess one of the things I ask myself is that if I'm doing something which I'm pretty sure is completely safe, there isn't a part of me that is a little bit nervous about what's going to happen with that interaction, then I feel like I'm probably treading on something I've already done before. And working with other people and inviting them into that relationship with you is definitely a way of avoiding that.
The material then transfers into something that's more physical, because it seems quite different. There's this whole sea of data and virtual, and then this different space, and then there's the books, and then there's the sculptural piece, which have a very different presence in the world. So how does that relationship go?
Yeah, again, something which I'm very often kind of troubled over. Because sometimes I kind of, like, my history is more in making videos, really, and text. So that's really my kind of background, but I'm an artist. So there's an immediate problem there, which is, you know, what is it, what stuff do you actually put in the space? And how do you distribute, I mean, and how do you create a platform for your work if you work in this way? And, you know, really, most of the time, if you go to one of my exhibitions, what you'll see is a video, actually. It's not, you know, it's quite a familiar object by now that you go to, you know, there's nothing kind of like, whoa, about seeing a video when you go into space. So in terms of the materiality of a video and how that compares to online, I mean, again, like, one of the things that I wanted to do with making videos was to kind of get away from this idea that there had to be only one specific way to see a video. And, you know, it had to be like on a red velvet couch at -3 degrees with curtains or you know, with particular props. I'm sure that doesn't exist, but, you know, this idea that there's like some, to being very kind of precious about the installation, which I think that in art schools, that, you know, that's kind of what you're taught. And if you're not really, really precious to the point of being a bit diva about the way that it's installed, that you're probably a bit of a crap artist. And I was kind of more interested in this idea of, well, you know, most, like nowadays, if you put your stuff online, you know, you may tell people that they can only see it in -3 degrees and with red velvet couch, but they're going to see it on their phones probably or on a laptop. So rather than kind of denying that, how can we take that on board and like bake that into the things we do, and also understand that, you know, they will exist in different formats, whether or not you will desire them to. So how can you actually, you know, make use of that? By essentially publishing in different formats. So the gallery becomes one way of publishing, of sharing a thing. And, you know, one of the things I didn't say with the empathy deck, the kind of card tower, is that I ended up thinking of that as a kind of proxy for the bot, because it's not really the real work. Like, it's not live, it's not changing, it's just a stack of cards. But you've got to put something there, and we didn't want to put another... we didn't want to make it time-based. We wanted to make it something that almost stood in for the liveness. So it's almost like an advert or something. So it's got a very different character to the bot itself.
It looked like a display.
Yeah, it's a display. It's like going into a shop and seeing a kind of, you know, like at Christmas where they have big stars.
And
something.
That's what it echoed in.
Yeah. And books. Mm-hmm. Yeah, publications too.
Yeah.
And that's something very permanent. Yeah. Or unchangeable when it's in that form, so...
Totally, yeah. That's very...
It's scary.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, I find that. Yeah, because you can't... I mean, that's the thing with a book, once it's out there, you can't record it in the way that you maybe could with your work and your previous stuff and your blogs and Twitter. You could delete it. So, yeah, there's something... Something changes when this kind of potentially ephemeral space of publishing and broadcasting becomes kind of immortalised... in the way that it does in print. And also, it's a different type of distribution, but it is a distribution as well.
We have time for one question before we repair to the tap in the station for a drink before Eric gets her train, which you're welcome to join us. Or you can sidle up to her at the bar and ask your question. It's kind of creepy.
You were talking a lot about that empty bot, the Twitter thing, towards the end, and you mentioned that it will filter out people that are not, so I've said like racial slurs or homophobic things. But like, What do you feel about the idea that only certain people deserve empathy? Because obviously that's what the bot's trying to do. And if someone's accidentally said a slur, like let's say their Twitter said, oh my God, I can't believe so-and-so just said nigger, that's so horrible. Mm. Like they're not trying to use it in a racist way, but it might filter them out and like push that out.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, which I think in itself, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on in the world at the moment, there's so much about that to do with, like, essentially kind of free speech. You know, well, should we jump to the worst conclusions about people who say things? And, I mean, I guess I'm more inclined to say yes. I kind of think we should.
Don't take any risks.
Yeah, well, but particularly when it's an automated agent like that, it's an automated intelligence. I can't take the risk because the bot can't possibly deduce and read between languages. And also, I personally would never say that word out loud. So I would like definitely not want my bot or my creation to respond to it. But that's the thing, is that the bot can't understand humour, it can't understand kind of maybe or ambivalence, it's just picking up on particular words. So there's a need to be really careful with those words, because whereas I might be able to understand that and go like, it was probably meant like this or like that, the bot's not going to, and I wouldn't want it to be accidentally getting into conversation or responding to people who I would then, when I check their profile, think, oh God, that this person's a racist, and you know, now my bot is like responding to it. But I think the other thing that you're asking about, you know, are only certain people deserving of empathy? I think is a really good question, and it's a difficult one, because you know, for me, somebody who's being racist, and especially in the world that we're living in now, like with the way that things are turning out and the kind of global world order, like I don't want to give that person empathy. Maybe there's something else that could be given, like spoken to or explained things. But I don't know about empathy. I think there are limits there, and I also think there are limits to free speech, because I think when free speech becomes something that ends up really hurting other people, I'm not behind it. And of course, there's a kind of alt-right idea that means that you're against free speech, but that's not something I agree with.
Right, we have to end. Thank you very much, Erica, for such a fantastic talk and discussion. Thank you all for coming.